Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 221. This is our last episode on James Meredith and the Oxford Riot. Some of you may be happier than others with that, but I think these episodes serve their purpose. For most of you, I think this dog did hunt. Well, no pun intended. You know, after this whole thing was all over, Time magazine would write that the Oxford Riot was the gravest conflict between the state and federal authority since the Civil War. President Kennedy was forced to invoke the Insurrection Act of 1807, and it mobilized over 30,000 troops in total. For a single disturbance, it was the most ever in the history of our country. It was also the final time that troops were deployed on any scale during the Civil Rights Movement. In some ways, it was a pivotal point, and a point of crescendo when it came to massive public resistance to desegregation, and massive public resistance to the Civil Rights Movement. In general, it's hard for any of us to imagine the existence of the military in our local neighborhood, there to peacekeep. Even harder for us to imagine our neighbors all getting together, grabbing their shotguns, their rifles, and their pistols, and their bricks, and all heading up to the campus of our nearby university in search of a good federale to take a shot at. And if you don't think I'm serious about that, General Billingsley's men apprehended a group of students who were in possession of a cache of M1 rifles stolen right there during the entire incident, stolen from the local ROTC. That tells only part of the story, though, of what those people were doing that day. They were not only looking for a federale to shoot, but they were also looking for a very specific black man named James Meredith. One would assume that venture was to find him and to go and lynch. They were equally angered by the prospect of a presence of either. It's a miracle, then, of course, that the bloodshed was kept to a minimum. There were 160 U.S. Marshals that were injured during the riot. 28 of those men received gunshot wounds. Only two people were officially counted as having been killed during the riots, Ray Gunter and Paul Gehard. For a very long time, and I suppose maybe even today, you could witness gunshot holes still present in the most hallowed hall of the Ole Miss campus, the Lyceum. Shots in the stone pillars and along the front facade. It was a building that at that moment then housed the Assistant Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Today, you can find a very small plaque right there at the Lyceum. It's small enough that if you weren't looking, you might trip over it. Perhaps made that small because it was not considered to be Mississippi's finest hour, at least by most. According to historian Bill Doyle, it is a sheer miracle that scores, if not hundreds, of Americans were not slaughtered that night. But Doyle would go on to say that, nevertheless, it broke the back of massive resistance to integration. Leaders lead however they do it. And in the case of Governor Ross Barnett, he was willing to stand up to the President of the United States. What message does that send to the populace? Certainly, almost everyone who was radical enough to do so took it as a green light to resist and to use force in doing so. Barnett was a deceitful man. In the middle of this fight, at 11 p.m. on Sunday night, in a radio address, he would reverse some of the conciliatory language used earlier that evening on television and declaring on the radio that we shall never surrender. Yep. True colors on total display that evening on the radio. Shame on you, sir. When rumors abounded that Barnett would be arrested by federal authorities, the White Citizens Council prepared to send a wall of human flesh, some 2,000 people, to surround and protect him. It was a completely distorted picture of what was good and right. but it was their picture, and by God, it was sanctioned all the way to the top of the pyramid of governance in the Deep South, and particularly in the state of Mississippi at the time. The ugliness of Sunday night and into Monday and beyond was for the most part concentrated in a crowd that was estimated to be about 2,500 to 3,000 on the campus. In the moments before and in the gathering storm, it was rumored to be far greater. One of the reasons for the overreach by the federal authorities in their preparation. And it would have been far greater had the entrances to the campuses not been ultimately secured. And ironically, it likely would have included a great deal of the state police, the very people originally entrusted with keeping outsiders away. Yes, it would have included them, had certain officials not talked their own guard into standing down and not participating in the riot with the rest of the crowd. Unbelievable as that observation may seem to all of us now, it is true. Yes, as the story goes, Lieutenant Governor Paul Johnson actually talked a group of state troopers from going to the campus and launching an armed attack on U.S. Marshals. Knowing this, how would a simple citizen in Mississippi think he had a chance in hell of standing up to the local authorities or find protection or justice in any way when defiance of the law in that form was found at the highest level of law enforcement in the state? Someone should make a movie about Mr. Birdsong, the head of the Highway Patrol then. I'm sure that one would make your toes curl. The execution of the military plan and Meredith's entrance was quite sloppy, but the resolution was unequivocal, and it came about from the will of the president himself, and how resolute he was on this matter. He would wax eloquent on Sunday evening, attempting, as Lincoln had 100 years earlier, to dissuade the violence and the hate with elegant words and higher wisdom. But prejudice recedes ever so slowly, generations it takes, after any big convulsion. This was a small one compared to our Civil War that Lincoln was to preside over, but it was, nevertheless, a convulsion. Kennedy would use encouraging words of praise aimed at the head and at the heart of the citizens of Mississippi, even though, right at that very moment, the riots were really already beginning. It was a most quintessential example, and I keep reminding you of the relative immaturity of the technology age, the communication age, at that moment. A far cry from what we now live in. There were no cell phones, no instantaneous communication, not even with the president. Throughout this story, you hear the almost absurd tale of the use of payphones to call the Pentagon, or to call even the White House. The poor planning resulted in a massing of manpower that, in the end, turned out to be far greater than the real danger of the force at hand. A waste of resources in one sense, but a guarantee of victory in another. No one will quibble with the outcome. The ugliness of the crowd was there, including some real characters, including, as you might expect, some of the characters that we will spend more time with later as we pivot to the next discussion around the radical right. Some of them were not even from Mississippi, and Robert Shelton, an imperial wizard of the KKK, is a good example. He was, by the way, well acquainted, as we shall see, with Joseph Miltier. He was joined by many others from various elements of the KKK, including 19 from Louisiana clans. And yes, there was Edwin Walker. What a story that was. You'll hear a bit more in today's episode about him. But on Walker, there is so much more to come, so just stay tuned. Walker himself is credited with a great deal of the agitation at Oxford, and he gave the cry for 10,000 volunteers in a radio address before the riot began, partly spurring the Army's overcompensation. How ironic for the military man who had just 4 years earlier in Little Rock, Arkansas, well, he was the man on the ground enforcing the federal orders to ensure desegregation of Little Rock High School during the Eisenhower administration. Folks, you just can't write this stuff. Back to one of our main characters, Ross Barnett, the then governor of Mississippi, and, of course, an avowed segregationist. He gives us so many examples of what a political possum does in a situation like this. His passionate conversation with the president and the attorney general, as you heard on the tape in the last episode. Well, in the end, despite his attempts of evasion, he was to trap himself in a senseless dash away from the inevitable. He would foolishly offer on Monday morning to pay for Meredith's out-of-state tuition as a final last gesture out of the mess. A ridiculous offer, and it was one that was rejected out of hand like so many of the other ridiculous offers he proposed throughout the proceedings. They say that history is written by the victors, but in the aftermath, the local press in Mississippi did not see it as a victory. Not yet. Not a victory yet by the federal government. And so their depiction at the time was that the riot was blamed on trigger-happy marshals when they fired off the first tear gas. That same story was shared by a few of the university officials as well. Thankfully, many more university officials thought differently, and many of those who had not sanctioned that first story were quick to sign a letter of protest, indicating that such statements were simply not true. They would defend the marshals and make it clear that the protesters had initiated the violence. By one account, there were 182 journalists who covered the story. Everyone likes a good story. So in the end, there was enough of them to tell the truth. Enough of them so much that the truth could prevail. What you have heard in these last episodes comes from an official military history of the Oxford Riot, contained in a publication entitled The Role of Military Forces in Domestic Disorders between 1945 and 1992, and it was written by Paul J. Shipes. It is a superb and incredibly detailed accounting of the military history surrounding the event. But make no mistake about it, this ugliness did not encompass everyone. Yes, there was a broad-based belief in segregation in Mississippi in the day, but to paint everyone, even in Mississippi, with that brush would be wrong. Don't we all know that by now? So shame on me for not making that clear right from the very start. And the reason I bring that up now is because I was reminded of that rather poignantly by an email that I received just a few days ago. It came from an ardent and dedicated listener of this podcast, a Mississippian that, for this purpose, I will simply give the name of John. His email says it all, so I'm going to read it to you now. Hi, Jeff. Again, I really appreciate all your hard work. Thanks. And I don't mind your sidetracks concerning prehistories toward later Kennedy theories, although I know much of it already. Even though I was born in New Orleans in 1961, my family moved to a big house on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, past Christian, and we did so when I was 2 years old. This is an old, historic fishing and yachting town, and we lived right on the beach across Highway 90 until we later moved back to New Orleans in late 1973. In fact, our house was only two houses away from a huge place called the Dixie White House, with an historical marker stating that Woodrow Wilson had stayed there a few times. Culturally, the Mississippi Gulf Coast isn't much like inland Mississippi. Of course, it was still the Deep South in some ways, all the same. I went to a private Episcopal school in nearby St. Louis, where there were no black students. I don't remember any overt Southern cause education. In retrospect, there seemed to be an avoidance towards anything to do with the past in that respect. Although we did go to Jefferson Davis's old estate in Biloxi, Beauvoir, on field trips a few times, and there were historic exhibits there, I don't remember it as being anything but a great way for kids to get away from school and have a picnic outdoors. Of course, I was sometimes exposed to racist people, but I also knew people who were, in various degrees, further towards the opposite end of the spectrum. I've never thought of myself as anything but a product of the environment I grew up experiencing. My family was not prejudiced or racist. I never really knew what was happening in social society. I, unfortunately, had a very isolated, naive upbringing. Throughout my life, I've often made the mistake of saying that I grew up in Mississippi, and sometimes, ironically, paid for it with a resulting prejudice from people who don't understand. Whether you try to explain or do nothing but look at them, you will lose. So I sometimes don't tell people I grew up in Mississippi. Signed, John. Well, I think that says it all. Never judge a book by its cover. So, as we come to the end of this wander, well, yes, there is the remainder of this episode. Anticlimactic, perhaps, but there is still a need to finish. And finish strong, we will. So let's listen to the rest of episode 221 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. By 8:30 p.m. Sunday, Oxford time, with the riot underway, lead elements of Bravo had reached Waynesboro, Tennessee. 2 hours later, the unit learned that it was to proceed directly to Oxford through Bolivar, Mississippi, and Holly Springs. Bravo's operational control now passed to General Billingsley. Bravo arrived in time to assist in bringing order to Oxford by daylight. By then, the federal force at the scene was too large for the tasks at hand. As a precaution, the buildup in the vicinity nonetheless continued for a time. The 1st Battle Group, 155th Infantry from Mississippi, found little to do but set up checkpoints to prevent undesirables from entering Oxford. Task Force Laurel, Echo, built around the 720th Military Police Battalion at Fort Hood, was employed in the same manner. The unit also manned roadblocks at critical points on the main roads entering the city, conducted patrols and searches, confiscated weapons, and they apprehended 47 persons, and turned both weapons and detainees over to the marshals. The last of the 5 task forces that had been planned before the riot, Task Force Delta, organized around the 2nd Battle Group, 1st Infantry, stationed at Fort Benning, well, it never moved any closer than Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi, where it was held until it was ordered back to Fort Benning a week later. At about 7:30 Monday morning, Billingsley met with the unit commanders who were present and set up 2 task forces for controlling the campus and the city. About the time that Billingsley was having his conference, a group of soldiers and marshals, including Chief Marshal James McShane and John Doerr, who was the U.S. Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, escorted James Meredith into the Lyceum through a back door for registration as a junior in the College of Liberal Arts. An hour later, with his escort, Meredith went to his first class. But even as Meredith registered, rioters prowled the streets of Oxford. Shortly thereafter, Billingsley moved his command post to the National Guard Armory in Oxford, where the first order of business became dealing with the remaining troublemakers. At 9 o'clock that morning, responding to a request for assistance by Oxford's mayor, Richard Elliott, soldiers dispersed a stubborn mob in the Oxford city square. The town's police force contained only 7 men, and the state troopers, as the mayor put it, were just sitting around and watching. Armored vests were now being worn by some of the men, providing them protection against objects thrown by the mob. At about that time, the troops apprehended a major troublemaker, retired Major General Edwin A. Walker, who had been spotted at a roadblock the night before and was thought to have strongly influenced the actions of the mob in the Oxford Square, where he had also been present. In fact, he had delivered a prior radio address urging for 10,000 volunteers to come to Mississippi and join in the action. Informing Washington and learning that the Department of Justice intended to seek a warrant for the general's arrest, Katzenbach issued instructions for Walker's detention. The next morning, when the mob at the city square dispersed and Walker attempted to flee, he was recognized and halted by a lieutenant, Robert Clark, the commander of Company B, 2nd Battle Group, 9th Infantry. Escorted to the Lyceum at about 11:30 that morning, he was charged with seditious conspiracy and insurrection, and he was placed under arrest. He would be sent off to a federal psychiatric facility, but he was prematurely released after less than a week. And later, when a federal grand jury declined to indict the general, the government dropped the charges against him. Governor Barnett was another source of concern. With rumors circulating that he might come to Oxford, Billingsley requested guidance on what action to take if he did. Authorized by President Kennedy and Secretary of Defense McNamara, the guidance issued shortly after 9 o'clock that morning, on Monday, stipulated that any aircraft bearing Barnett should be denied permission to land at Oxford. The Federal Aviation Agency was then alerted in case one of its control towers might be involved, and two companies of Keller's task force were dispatched to carry out the instructions. One went to University Oxford Airport, while the other hastened to a small airfield 8 miles south of Oxford that belonged to the Champion Oil Company. In this case, the precautions proved unnecessary. Barnett never made an appearance. By 10:30 a.m. on Monday, Billingsley was able to report that about 100 persons had been detained and that the town of Oxford, despite the continuing presence of a large number of outsiders, was quiet. One trouble spot, however, required stern action. A portion of the mob that had been driven from the campus lingered at the intersection of South Lamar Boulevard and University Avenue, where members of the group brandished iron pipes and spikes and threw bricks, bottles, and debris at every passing soldier. To handle this problem, Martin created two special detachments of about 40 men each, including some members of Troop E, 108th Armored Cavalry. About mid-morning, he approached the intersection with his troops, probably keeping one of the two forces in reserve. The mob responded with such menace that he ordered shots fired into the air. After about 15 rounds, the mob dispersed. Martin detained 40 or more of the demonstrators and turned them over to the marshals. The riot at Oxford was over. But problems for the government and the army had just begun. Some had to do with the inevitable political fallout. On the afternoon of October 1st, an ardent segregationist, Congressman John Bell Williams of Mississippi, wired Secretary Vance to find out who ordered Mississippi National Guardsmen to fire over the heads of their fellow citizens in Oxford. The Army looked into the allegations, but of course found no substance in them. In fact, reported Billingsley's successor, Lieutenant General Hamilton M. Howes of the 18th Airborne Corps, and I quote, "University officials stated that the soldiers conducted themselves in an exemplary manner and that at no time was any brutality whatsoever observed." Suits for damages under the Federal Tort Claims Act were filed by a number of plaintiffs, but all ultimately failed. On campus, Meredith remained unwelcome, and he posed problems for the president. President Kennedy continued to view the situation with deep concern, and after an unsatisfactory telephone conversation with Governor Barnett early Monday morning, there was still much to do. Supporting greater federal intervention, he approved a troop buildup that now went far beyond the total strength contemplated in the pre-riot planning. Consideration was even given to moving a regular Army division to Oxford, and the president himself appears to have thought about using Marine ground forces. The approximate strength of all units alerted, deployed, and committed in the Oxford area, including the Federalized Mississippi Air and Army National Guards, was 30,656 by official count. Probably until then, the largest buildup for a single disturbance in the nation's history. The maximum number of regular Army troops deployed for the operation reached a total of about 20,600 on October 6th. The actual number of troops committed to the Oxford area peaked on October 2nd at about 12,000. Of those, 9,300 were regulars and 2,700 members of the Mississippi Air and Army National Guards. In the aftermath of Meredith's admission, there was a need for a continuing peacekeeping presence in Oxford. The Army selected General Howes to command the force that was to stay in place. Assuming his duties at 3 p.m. on Monday, he would have the same role and followed essentially the same instructions as Brigadier General Billingsley had. He was directly responsible to the Chief of the Army, General Wheeler, and he had overall responsibility for a sphere of activity that embraced not only the Oxford area, exclusive of the 10th City, but also the two staging areas. At that time, or shortly thereafter, the Army scaled back its strength around Oxford to 10,000 men at most. Howes, upon assuming command, would hold a cordial one-hour meeting with Chancellor of the University, John D. Williams, and he solicited his cooperation. This marked the beginning of a consultative relationship between the Army and the University that continued for a long time, as long as troops remained in Oxford. Howes also met with Katzenbach, who agreed on at least the outlines of a modus operandi between the Marshals and the Army for Meredith's ongoing protection. The plan provided for a prompt reduction in the number of marshals in Oxford, with a small group that remained functioning as a constant escort for Meredith. Meanwhile, the Army would guard Baxter Hall and serve as a support force. Under those arrangements, commanders maintained a Jeep patrol, known as the Peanut Patrol from its call sign, and they would do it with an alert platoon in reserve, bivouacked in a gully, known locally as the Hole, and located behind Baxter Hall. The alert platoon provided security details for the building, but its principal mission was to respond in case of trouble, either there or elsewhere on the campus. A larger reserve force formed the main body of troops stationed at Oxford after the major redeployments of October ended. It was divided at first between an encampment at the Armory and one at the University of Oxford Airport. But after March 1963, the two bases were combined into a single camp located a mile south of Baxter Hall. Meredith had hoped that the attention focused on his enrollment would quickly disappear so that he could pursue his studies quietly. But that was not to be. Marshals were with him wherever he went. They ate with him, and they slept in a room adjoining his in Baxter Hall. The Jeep patrol followed him as inconspicuously as possible. Four deputy marshals also worked undercover for a time, posing as students, with one remaining on this duty for the entire school year. As at Little Rock, the minutiae of student life became national issues, including the lack of black men guarding Meredith. It was James Meredith himself who brought the issue to a head. Not unnaturally, it seemed odd to him that the troops guarding him and seen elsewhere on the campus were segregated. He complained to General Howes, who explained that the policy had been adopted at Washington's discretion. When Meredith made his objections known, the matter was discussed at the highest levels, and President Kennedy directed full integration of all assignments at Oxford, except those involving individual duty at isolated posts where a black soldier might face serious danger. On October 6th, Howes issued the necessary orders. But Meredith, still angry, renewed his complaints, and this time he did it to the press. General Howes assured Wheeler that the new policy was being implemented without foot dragging, the only exception being the guards at Baxter Hall, who checked students' identification. It was a matter of good judgment not to put Negroes in such position, he would say, not put in such a position of control over white students whose prejudices on this matter are extraordinarily strong. But Meredith continued to complain to the press, saying that the only blacks he had seen were on a garbage detail. And his complaint was never answered directly. In the meantime, a campaign of random harassment and catcalls began, which, unlike the riot, was directed specifically at Meredith and those who guarded him. The most common of the 80 or more incidents that occurred between October 1962 and June of 1963 involved firecrackers and much more dangerous cherry bombs that were thrown at sentries on duty. There were also bomb threats. On the evening of October 29th, a small riot also took place on campus. It began at the university cafeteria while Meredith was eating, and it drew a crowd of about 100 to 150 students. The military police security patrol, which had remained outside, was the focus of the initial antagonism and took a barrage of firecrackers and eggs. A privately owned car then tried to run a military police vehicle off the road. Later that evening, a great number of students filled the windows in dormitories overlooking Baxter Hall, throwing eggs, firecrackers, bottles, cherry bombs, and at least one Molotov cocktail. Using slingshots, students fired marbles at the sentries, one of them striking the sergeant of the relief guard just below the eye. Large groups gathered on this street south and east of Baxter Hall until a dean prevailed upon the campus police, who had not previously intervened, and they would then move the students back to their rooms. Although the Army recognized the disorganized nature of the incident and called no more troops other than sentries, the matter seemed serious for a time. A potentially dangerous episode, for example, occurred about 5:30 when an enlisted man in Company B, 716th Military Police Battalion, Private First Class Dominic Niglia, fired into a dormitory window after a cherry bomb, and what was probably a bottle filled with blasting powder exploded near him. The bullet struck no one, but ricocheted off a corridor wall before lodging in a doorframe. Frightened, the soldier reported the shot, justifying it on the grounds that he had feared for his life and had fired a warning shot in self-defense. The incident created a considerable stir that led to independent investigations by both the grand jury and the Army. In the end, citing the dangerous harassment the sentries had undergone and Niglia's previously unblemished record, the Army declined to prosecute him. Another major incident occurred during the early evening of October 31st when a military policeman walking his post at Baxter Hall was struck in the left eye by fragments of a cherry bomb thrown from a nearby dormitory. A report surfaced that there were 17 sticks of dynamite in Baxter Hall. The university requested that the Army assist the campus police in a search of that building and a nearby dormitory, whose residents had been implicated in recent troubles. The search turned up firecrackers, knives, clubs, one gas grenade, a gasoline can with a small quantity of gasoline, and a .22 caliber rifle. A threatening haul, even for Halloween. After the disorders of October 29th through 31st, bomb threats and other incidents kept Meredith's protections on the alert. Even so, a relative calm settled over Oxford. University cooperation with Army headquarters showed improvement, particularly where investigations of student acts against Meredith and campus security personnel were concerned. Apparently, the faculty and administration had been impressed by the potentially lethal character of some of the disorders, and not to mention that there was a possibility that the university's accreditation might fall into question if the institution failed to maintain order on its campus. This did not mean, however, that university life was becoming easier for Meredith. He would again be the subject of hazing. Hodges immediately stepped into a tense situation precipitated by the hazing of Meredith on campus. As a result of the intense pressure and toll that all of this had taken on him, on January 7th, Meredith had issued a statement that he would not register for the second semester, and I quote, "unless very definite and positive changes are made to make my situation more conducive to learning." The statement worried his friends among the faculty who wanted him to see the ordeal through, and it set off criticism of the university by Robert Kennedy in Washington, and it infuriated white students who launched a new wave of harassment and disorder on campus. Throughout January, Meredith faced harassment that ranged from insulting language to fireworks. In the cafeteria, he was greeted by stomping of feet, rapping on glasses, and crowding tactics in line. The tires on his automobile were slashed and the antenna broken. Meredith's departure at the end of the first semester was quiet and orderly, Hodges reported, but no one knew what to expect if and when he returned. Hodges ordered intensified training in riot control and use of chemical munitions and equipment, and they prepared to use the water hoses of two decontamination vehicles. And they also planned and maintained rooftop security and surveillance on the campus during registration. They ensured that shotguns were on hand, and they readied battery-powered portable loudspeakers and gas masks. Army planners made special arrangements to reinforce Hodges and the marshals, if necessary, and Lieutenant Colonel Thomas J. McGuire of the General Staff went to Oxford as a representative of the Chief of Staff and the department. At the end of January, Meredith held a news conference in Jackson, and he announced that he would return to the university for the second semester. Fortunately, the return was without trouble, in part, as Meredith realized, because every precaution had been taken to see that he enrolled safely. All in all, he wrote later, more security measures were taken for my second enrollment than for the first. According to Hodges, the students received Meredith with complete indifference, which Hodges concluded was evidence that the university had taken effective measures to maintain discipline on the campus. His one remaining fear was the possibility that some individual or small group might assassinate Meredith. Later, although no serious problems developed, hazing and harassment resumed, leaving the Army no choice but to continue its presence on campus. As a result, Hodges ended his tour as commander at Oxford on a campus where a small military presence had become almost routine. He turned over command of the Oxford forces to Colonel William R. Lynch, Jr., the last USA Fox commander, and he did so on May 1, 1963. After Lynch arrived, he faced not only continuing incidents on campus, but a potentially serious fracas in downtown Oxford on May 18th, when three unidentified blacks assaulted a university freshman. A small crowd gathered, but city and campus policemen stepped in to disperse it. Tense moments of that sort notwithstanding, Lynch concluded during May that student reaction against Meredith had lessened. He himself did all he could to moderate local feelings by working hard to promote good relations with the university and Oxford communities. He also made a good impression on Meredith himself, who later recalled that, "I knew Colonel Lynch better and had more contact with him than with any of the other commanders. He always came to inform me of any major changes in policy." Lynch believed at the beginning of May that the existing troop strength of 31 officers and 269 enlisted men was the minimum necessary for performing his mission. With the summer session coming up and reduced enrollments in prospect, however, he thought he might make the sort of changes that would reduce the Army's presence on the campus. Since early April, there had been at least six bomb threats and the explosion of a homemade device at a dormitory that blew out six windows. As Wheeler saw it, the Army's mission in Oxford to remove obstructions to the court order was the equivalent of securing Meredith from bodily harm or harassment. In this view, if the Mississippi officials take on this chore, we can be relieved of it. If they don't, we can't. Even as it was, with the marshals providing close-in protection, the university, the outer cordon, and the Army, and its strategic reserve, he still believed he could not guarantee Meredith's security, even though, as he put it, we are still on the hook for it. Complications increased when a second black student was admitted to the university for the summer session. 21-year-old Cleve McDowell of Drew, Mississippi, was an honor student of Jackson State College. He had applied months before for admission to the university's law school, and on June 3rd, a court order forbade the university to deny him admittance. Troubled at the prospect of having two black students at a time when the governor still vehemently opposed any integration at all, Chancellor Williams told Lynch that if difficulties arose over McDowell's registration, he had no one but the Army to turn to. For a time, the situation seemed alarming. Lynch began to prepare for a replay of the earlier crisis, urging that an additional military police company be moved to Oxford by June 4th or June 5th, and that the Army earmark a standby force and that the government maintain close surveillance of the Mississippi National Guard authorities. The Departments of Justice and the Army agreed to enlarge the Peanut Patrol and to alert the other elements of Lynch's force. Governor Barnett appeared at the upcoming registration. As in the past, although liaison remained essential, little reliance could be placed on local or state police for assistance. The Oxford forces went on full alert at about 8:15 in the morning Oxford time on Wednesday, June 5, 1963. Army aircraft kept McDowell under continuous observation from the time he left Jackson until he arrived at the university, traveling with four federal marshals in two cars. During his registration, completed shortly after about 3 o'clock on Wednesday, the Peanut Patrol, the marshals, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and Army intelligence kept him under surveillance. The upshot of all this activity was an unexpected but very welcome anticlimax. Instead of crowds, only reporters and a few state officials showed up. There were no state police cars on the campus, although 8 were reported in Oxford. Contenting himself with a bitter address on television, Governor Barnett did not appear. Neither did he send any representatives. Colonel Lynch viewed the routine character of McDowell's registration and the university's efforts that had brought it about as a favorable turn of events that strongly indicated the desirability of an immediate but planned withdrawal of Army elements from Oxford. Almost equally impressive was Meredith's uneventful return to the campus and his registration the following day. On June 17th, 7 officers and 124 enlisted men left Oxford. Aside from Meredith, those most uneasy with the soldiers' departure were the university officials. Speaking confidentially for the chancellor and faculty in mid-June, Dean Leston L. Love requested that the Army remain in Oxford until the governor made some kind of commitment to guarantee peace and order. After various events, on July 19th, Califano drafted a memorandum for Secretary Vance that summed up the situation. In it, he indicated the concurrence of a number of important players, and he recommended that all remaining troops be withdrawn from Oxford immediately. Department of Justice officials signed on quickly, agreeing that a withdrawal should take place on Thursday, July 25th, 1963, just about 10 months from the date that Meredith first stepped on campus. There was to be neither publicity nor press releases, though media queries would be answered. The Army left Oxford more quietly than it came. Thank you for listening to episode 221 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.